Hi, and welcome to the first episode of Greater Perspectives. We have Neil Chilson, who is the former chief technologist at the FTC and currently a senior fellow for the Center for Growth and Opportunity. Love to have you here. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm excited to be here. Thanks for having me. Big picture, started out as a computer scientist, went to undergrad and grad school for that. In grad school, got really interested in policy issues. Everybody who was doing policy issues at that time had law degrees, so I thought I'd stop getting paid to go to school and start paying to go to school. It turned out fine. It was expensive though.
To be fair, I mean, mixing computer science and law, and you know, I feel like that's a really good combination. So
probably I mean, it's turned out to be great. You know, different types of thinking, very much so, and it's been useful to be able to sometimes bridge the gap between those two communities and the different mental models that they have about how to improve the world. After some time in private practice, I got a chance to join Maureen Olhausen, who at the time was a commissioner at the Federal Trade Commission. I joined her office. Eventually, when she was acting chairman, she picked me to be the acting chief technologist for about 9 months under the beginning of the Trump administration. So got to do a lot in the tech policy space. The Federal Trade Commission is sometimes jokingly called the Federal Technology Commission because of its broad antitrust and consumer protection roles and how they affect the technology companies that otherwise don't have specific regulators. And so
everybody seems to be starting a new social media right now. Mm-hmm. And I think it's pretty interesting from my perspective, because I think they're all getting it wrong. It's just people are continuing to do the same problems and rehash the same like centralist approach to social media over and over again. And I've heard in some of your other podcasts in the past, you've talked about Reddit and their decentralized moderation model. Is it possible to expand that model for basically decentralizing an entire community's moderation? And if you were, could you do it as a generalist rather than, you know, these like kind of Reddit micro communities that they have?
Yeah. So there's lots of experiments in how you would do decentralized. Reddit is one way where they sort of have, you know, local communities. And in those communities, I mean, there's quite a variation in how they might moderate. So you can have a pretty dictatorial, you know, Reddit subreddit moderation policy. And then you can have ones that are very free ranging. So there's lots of experimentation even within that model. And I think that's great because different communities have different norms that they're trying to establish. But technically there is a challenge, right? The challenge is that there are centralized technical needs, right? So Reddit servers are run by Reddit, a company. And in order for them to decentralize, they'd have to give up, they'd have to find a way to fund, you know, that product in a way, those services in a way that is not under their control as well. And that's just technically very hard. It's not just technically. I mean, we have some tools to do decentralized, you know, provision of services, but I think it's more on the business side. It's very hard to figure out how do you make that revenue-wise work where you can pay for these social media platforms. I mean, the successful ones provide essentially like commercial grade communication services for free to most users. And that's that model's really hard to do in a decentralized way from a technical standpoint. And so
The tech is extremely difficult, at least the way I see it. You know, and not just that it's not theoretically possible to make things decentralized. Like you could in theory, everyone could have their own server and that represents their profile and their posts, and then they're in control and own their own, you know, environment. But at the same time, like what happens when someone's server goes down? How do you bring it all together in a feed? You know, how do you guarantee quality of service and scale on all of these individual levels? And it's just not like, you know, you'd have
how do you do it in a way that makes it so easy that people don't face a high barrier, because you want lots of users. The network effects in these sites is really important. People use them because there's a lot of people on them. if you make it hard to get in, maybe for communities that works, but for a lot of, for like a lot of users, that's going to be a barrier. That's just too high for them to
join. Yeah. So. Yeah. And the computation alone is insane. Like collecting all of the, creating the feeds and managing feeds is still surprisingly difficult.
Yeah.
But when you get into places like what Twitter and X does, where they have these kind of algorithmic feeds, where it's not actually a chronological order of what you expect. It's more of this fancy algorithm coming together and putting stuff together for you. Part of that, I think, is because it's easier than doing a chronological feed, which sounds kind of counterintuitive, right? Some advanced logic for picking posts is actually less intensive on the system than trying to get them all in order.
Yeah, I mean, I hadn't thought about that, but it makes perfect sense because nobody can tell you you did it wrong, right? Like, I mean, like chronological, like there's each person is going to have a very specific different thing. Whereas algorithmic, you could deliver the same feed. I mean, this isn't how those algorithms really work that often now, but like you could feasibly deliver the same feed to everybody and call it, it would be an algorithmic feed, but like nobody could tell you, you did it wrong. Right. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
So what do you think of, was it Grog or Grop or what is Grok. It the Twitter just came or X came out with?
Yeah, I think it's called Grok. It's like based on that Heinlein book or that term, like from the Heinlein book, Stranger in a Strange Land. I haven't actually had a chance to play with it. I've seen a lot of the sort of content that people have posted on X about it. I think the Musk's frame is that it will be a sort of much less sensorial.
Yeah, it's not going to censor as much as the other. But to be fair, I feel like I saw some posts the contrary saying, "Hey, we were testing that theory out, and that's not true."
Yeah.
And actually, if you look at kind of X as a whole, I don't, you know, the whole beating the free speech drum over there. I don't know that they're actually kind of living up to that. I think it's more of a marketing term, in my opinion.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to get away from the fact that users want a place that's useful to them. Mm-hmm. And in some sense, that means getting rid of the spam and getting rid of the, you know, distasteful content that the average person doesn't want to see. Right. Like, and so content moderation is a sort of inherent part of creating a product that a mass of users want. Not everybody wants a free, like a totally free for all. If they want a total free for all, like there are places on the internet you can get that. And it just turns out that those places are very messy and
people in general, it's not for the everyday consumer.
Right.
I think on one hand, like, you want to have good faith discussion. You want to have good faith debate. And if somebody has a view that maybe is controversial, you don't want to shut them down because of it. You want to allow everyone to have those discussions and try to do it respectfully.
Yeah.
It's just the real world isn't really made, or like the online world isn't really made for respectful discussion. It's made for kind of abuse with the anonymity and just the fact that you can spin up 10 accounts. X today is still filled with what I call these like sex bots, where you look in your direct messages and it's just, "Hey, come check out my profile, check out my OnlyFans."
Yeah.
And nobody wants that. Right. So,
yeah, I've seen a growing on Twitter as well, or on X, I've seen a growing trend towards sort of listicle. Some of it's very interesting, but it'll be like, "Here's a crazy story from history." And it's like, this
oh, I've gotten those too.
Yeah.
I think the algorithm is trying to feed people other things today.
Yeah.
I've been getting a lot of that stuff too. It's really interesting.
I think it's, a sort of, there's a bit of a sort of TikTokification in that way of some of the X feed. And I don't know exactly what to, make of that, but, I think it just shows that these are, evolving environments. Social media is like you said, there are a lot of choices out there and it seems like there's more every day. And with things like with tools like, ChatGPT, it's easier than ever to, pump out some,
pump out content, quality content, nonetheless.
Yeah. And to pump out code. Right. Like, and so, building these products, I think, we may see a time when people like, you know, kind of roll your own social media environments.
Well, I actually see that as being a good thing, like roll your own social media. I don't see that as a bad thing at all.
No,
I do kind of see it particularly annoying that everybody seems to be trying to describe themselves as solving the social media issue while literally doing the same thing as everybody else, the same centralized model, centralized moderation, and, you know, just basically being a little bit lighter or heavier in certain moderation topics. There's no innovation there.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's just directly downstream from having an ad based model, right? Like, it's very hard. You need as many users as possible, right? To do that and to have as many users as possible, you're going to aim at the median person, right? And to do that, your content policy is probably going to be similar to other people who are also aiming at getting that person online. Yeah. So I just think that's downstream from, you know, the business model. And
well, I also think that business model is particularly toxic because if you want to incentivize people being on there, coming back, looking at their feed, there are, and I don't have any of the studies in front of me, but it would be interesting to know, like, doesn't making people angry kind of drive them more onto social media, and doesn't making them upset? And that's why you see a lot of the features on social media kind of designed for outrage or over-sexualization or focusing on body or image. That stuff drives people on there, even though in general, it's probably not good for society.
Yeah. The research is mixed on this. And I think the business incentives are also quite mixed. The filter bubble conversation was a thing that people talked about a lot. And it turns out actually people see more contrary views on social media than they do, you know, watching MSNBC.
I can see that.
But that doesn't necessarily change their minds, right? Like, in fact, there's some evidence that being exposed to at least the social media version of somebody of a competing view can actually make you more rigid in your own views. And so there may still be a polarizing effect, but outside of that, I think the business incentives are very different, right? Advertisers don't want their content next to content. They don't want their ads next to content that makes people angry.
Yeah.
It's not good for their brand. And it's not a mood in which people are, you know, selling a lot of products.
And so
I do think that there is a business incentive to find that balance between engagement and positivity. And that's why I think, you know, I think that's where sort of TikTok had tried to do that, right? Like, there's not a lot of, at least from my limited experience on TikTok, it doesn't seem like a lot of outrage. A lot of it's like, you know, crazy fun stunts.
TikTok is the prank videos are a problem, but
in a different way.
The newest generation has a little bit of trouble understanding what a prank is. They think it's going into Walmart and throwing jugs of milk across the place, which is like,
that's a crime. That's not.
Yeah. It's not only is it a crime, it's just frustrating. Why do they think this is entertaining? Stop it. Like, these poor people, they're getting minimum wage. Leave them alone.
Yeah. Exactly.
But I do see Twitter as, or X as, a place where a lot of the engagement is, it's either like sycophantic praise or it's toxic, just anger and like vitriol. And I think, you know, I think it explains a lot about how they're having trouble with advertisers right now, because no one, like you said, no one wants to advertise next to a bunch of angry content. At the same time, you know, they have to offer large and steep discounts if they want people to advertise next to this kind of content.
Yeah.
And is somebody really going to be in the mood to buy Christmas presents after just being really angry about something somebody said?
Yeah.
So I doubt they're getting many clicks either. Yeah. So it's just, you know, this whole public ad debate is kind of interesting.
Yeah. It's a tough thing to crack, and, you know, fortunately, there's lots of people trying different things. You know, to circle back to the sort of decentralized discussion, I know there are people trying to build social media platforms that are highly decentralized. And we talked about the infrastructure problems there. But, I think finding a way to get away from the ad-based model is probably key to making that type of ecosystem work.
Well, you want the company to work for the consumers, not the company to work for other companies who are exploiting the consumers.
Right.
Is how I'd see it. You know, it's interesting because the Center of Growth and Opportunity, I was looking it up the other day, And they cover a lot of issues other than just tech, like environmentalism, immigration, a lot of different stuff. So how does that, does that kind of change the scope of what you've been working on lately? Or
so my focus is primarily in the tech policy work that they do. I would say all three of those issues, the Center for Growth and Opportunity, the focus is on how do we create an environment of abundance? How do we help ensure that people can break the barriers that prevent them from reaching their full potential? And a lot of those barriers are policy barriers. And so that's a big chunk of what we work on. But there's also, you know, societal barriers that hold people back. And then there's internal barriers that, you know, people's mental models for the world and what they can achieve in it. We very, you know, my focus has, given my background, is primarily on the policy front. But some of those social and institutional questions, I think, are really important. And really the primary sustainable way that you get, you know, abundant societies and is, you know, the character and the makeup of the people, in the community that really deliver. Policy is only as good as, you know, the people who are being restricted or enabled by it. So,
I know you have a book out.
Yeah. So the book is called Getting Out of Control, Emergent Leadership in a Complex World. And I try to tackle, I try to describe what a complex system is, and how emergent order, this idea that we can have extremely complex, orderly systems where no one is in control, but everybody contributes, how ubiquitous those are and what they mean for how we think about public policy, but also how we think about, you know, how we might advance in our own, you know, personal and family and community life. And so,
The first thing that comes to mind when you said that is this like complex structures, but with simple incentives is kind of what I'm thinking of. Like for example, the concept behind free market capitalism, the idea is that it's in everyone's best interest to earn money. And if everyone's earning money, they're adding the most value to society and therefore benefiting everybody else. So it's a complex system built on simple, like, you know, all this is theoretical, but yeah, built on simple incentive.
Yeah. Yeah. The market signals that say, and when we talk about a market, market's an abstract concept. What a market is really is it's the end result of millions and billions of people making decisions about how they're going to spend their time and their resources. Yeah. And when you get a vote that people want to spend their time and their resources in something that you're doing, that's a great signal that you should do more of it. And so, you know, the great thing about markets is that they channel our self-interest to productive ends for other people. And there's many examples. Markets are just one example of emergent systems. And we, you know, another big one that has a huge amount of influence on us are things like social norms, like, you know, which hand do you shake? Do you shake with somebody else and things like that? Or which side of the road do you drive on, which is a law, but started as a custom essentially, because you had to work that out together. And so,
So you're not just saying that these things have developed, you know, over time because of chaos. You're saying that they've actually introduced incentives into our everyday kind of routines now today, depending on which hand you shake with other people might also dictate, you know, which one you write with, or, you know, I don't know how often you frequently wash your hand. I don't know. I'm just trying to, but I think you get the concept, right?
Yeah. I mean, like, and language is the classic example, right? Like, nobody designs language. It comes about because people try out a new form of expression and it gets picked up and other people understand what it means in a very networked way. So we form a sort of community of understanding of something, and that's very organic. It's very bottom up, and it's flexible, but it's also consistent in a way. It's very resilient to pressure to try to change it. Big picture, I'm an optimist about the future, but a realist about like what policy can do. My big encouragement would be that when trying to figure out what problems we might have in technology, we need to take a sort of systems level view and think, what are the incentives that go into the creation of the problem, and how are people, what incentives are there to make it worse, and who has the incentive to make it better.
Yeah.
And who's best, who is best positioned to make decisions about whether or not the use of a technology will benefit or mm-hmm. harm individuals. So,
well, isn't that kind of the entire purpose of policy, is to just make sure that the incentives are set up properly so that everyone benefits?
Yeah. I mean, the big challenge is that policy is part of society as well. And so the individual policymakers have their own incentives. And
yeah, well, that's true. Sometimes so, they're not always that good.
Right. And so that's why we have constitutional structures and other things mm-hmm. that constrain the discretion of policymakers, and also constrain the amount in which we can let the energies of a crowd shape the rules at any one time. And so mm-hmm. we're a democracy, but we're a limited, a republic. And so we constrain how much our democratic impulses can, infringe on the rights of a minority. And that's that type of limited government approach is one that I think allows emergent order to come about, and yet still allows government to step in when there are challenges or harms that to individual rights that need to be addressed. We'll be right back.